one which he often made clear to any student or colleague who had the temerity to disagree with him. The scientific community can't accept a claim that only a single individual's judgment counts as evidence. If a theory includes the proviso that only its progenitor, or his acolytes, can assess its truth, then the theory exists to that extent outside of science. Freud's certainty and dogmatism are the sure signs of someone who is on shaky epistemic ground. And shaky ground is what many, if not most, psychologists and philosophers of science now believe to have been under Freud's feet most of the time. However, Freud's work gave rise to many hypotheses that are testable by normal scientific means, and some of these have received strong support, and not just from Americans. The notion discussed in Chapter 3 that the unconscious is a pre-perceiver is one such hypothesis. The evidence is by now overwhelming that people register countless stimuli simultaneously, only some of which get referred to the conscious mind for consideration, and that such non-conscious stimuli can markedly affect behavior. Research strongly supports other psychoanalytic theories. These include the concept of transference, by which feelings about parents or other important individuals that are formed in childhood are transferred more or less intact to other individuals later in life, and sublimation, by which feelings of anger or sexual desire that are unacceptable to a person are channeled into unthreatening activities such as artistic creation. In the hands of many of its adherents, psychoanalytic theory lacks sufficient constraints. For Freud, and for many of his followers, anything goes. If I say that the patient has an Oedipus complex, a desire to have sex with his mother, who is to say that's baloney? And on what grounds? Oedipus Schmedipus, as the Jewish mother said, as long as he loves his mother. Freud's theory of the psychosexual stages, oral, anal, phallic, latent, and genital, included the assertion that arrested development at one of the early stages was possible and would have a major impact on behavior. Toddlers who withheld their feces instead of making for mama would be stingy and obsessive-compulsive in adulthood. Freud would never have thought it worthwhile to try to find support for such hypotheses outside of the consulting room, and I very much doubt he would have been successful had he tried. We would say today that one of the chief ways that psychoanalysts derived their hypotheses was by applying the representativeness heuristic, matching cause and consequence on the basis of their perceived similarity. The psychoanalytic theorist Bruno Bettelheim deduced that the reason the princess in the fairy tale dislikes the frog is that its tacky, clammy feel is connected to children's feelings about sex organs. Who says children don't like their sex organs? And tacky, clammy? Well, never mind. And what's to keep me from saying that the princess dislikes the frog because the bumps on it remind her of pimples, which she dreads having, or that she's a nervous Nelly who's startled by the frog's rapid movements? The concept of the pleasure principle guided Freud's understanding of human nature until the 1920s. Life centered on satisfying the demands of the id for satisfaction of bodily needs, sex, and the discharge of anger. Dreams were usually about wish fulfillment. But the driving motives of wish fulfillment and the id's desires for life-satisfying gratifications seemed to be contradicted by the need of some Great War trauma victims to keep returning to thoughts about the disastrous events they had encountered. Freud also began to notice that children in their play sometimes fantasized the death of loved ones. Patients who were dealing with painful memories that had previously been repressed kept returning to them obsessively and without seeking resolution. And therapists regularly encountered masochists, people deliberately seeking out pain. Clearly, all these people were not being motivated by the pleasure principle, so there must be some drive opposed to it. Freud labeled this drive the death instinct, the desire to return to an inorganic state. The role of the representativeness heuristic in this hypothesis seems pretty clear. People's main goal in life is the pursuit of pleasure, but sometimes they seem to be seeking the opposite. Therefore, there is a drive toward personal extinction, facile and utterly untestable. My favorite example of the role of the representativeness heuristic in generating psychoanalytic hypotheses comes from reactions to a paper published in the American Journal of Psychiatry by Jules Masserman, at the time the president of the American Psychiatric Association. The burden of the paper, which was intended as a joke, was that ingrown toenails are symbols of masculine aspirations and intrauterine fantasies. To Masserman's chagrin, the journal was flooded by admiring commentary on his perspicacity. Theories more venerable and better supported by evidence than psychoanalytic theory also have problems with constraints, confirmation, and falsification. Evolutionary theory has generated thousands of testable and confirmed, or just as frequently disconfirmed, hypotheses about the adaptive nature of the characteristics of organisms. Why are female animals of some species faithful to a single male, and the females of other species promiscuous? Perhaps many mates increase the likelihood of reproduction in some species and not in others. Indeed, that turns out to be the case. Why do some butterflies wear flashy clothes? Explanation: to attract mates. Evidence: male butterflies that have their colors toned down by researchers don't do well in the mating department. Why should the viceroy butterfly mimic nearly perfectly the appearance of the monarch butterfly? Because the monarch is poisonous to most vertebrates, and it's to the viceroy's advantage. An animal only needs to fall ill once after eating a monarch in order to avoid ever after anything that resembles a monarch. But the adaptationist perspective is subject to considerable abuse, and not just by armchair evolutionists. A construct popular with both cognitive scientists and evolution theorists is the notion of mental modules, cognitive structures that evolution has developed for us that guide our ability to deal with some aspect of the world. Mental modules are relatively independent of other mental states and processes and owe little to learning. The clearest example of a mental module is language. No one today would attempt to explain human language as a purely learned phenomenon. The evidence for some degree of pre-wiring for language is overwhelming. Human languages are all similar at some deep level. They are learned at about the same age by people in all cultures, and they are served by specific areas in the brain. But module explanations by evolutionary theorists are too readily invoked. See a behavior and posit an evolved module for it. There are no obvious constraints on such explanations. They're as easy and unconstrained as are many psychoanalytic explanations. In addition to the overly facile nature of many evolutionary hypotheses and their violation of Occam's razor, many such hypotheses are not testable by any means currently available. We aren't obligated to pay attention to theories that are untestable, which isn't to say we're not allowed to believe untestable theories, just that we need to recognize their weakness compared to theories that are. I can believe anything I want about the world, but you have to reckon with it only if I provide evidence for it or an airtight logical derivation. The field of psychology affords many examples of too easy theorizing. Reinforcement learning theory taught us a great deal about the conditions that favor acquisition and extinction of learned responses. I can believe anything I want about the world, but you have to reckon with it only if I provide evidence for it or an airtight logical derivation. The field of psychology affords many examples of too easy theorizing. Reinforcement learning theory taught us a great deal about the conditions that favor acquisition and extinction of learned responses, such as a rat's pressing a lever to get food. The theory guided important applications such as treatment of phobias and machine learning procedures. But theorists in that tradition, who attempt explanations of complex human behavior in terms of presumed reinforcements, sometimes make the same mistakes as many psychoanalytic and evolutionary theorists. Little Oscar does well in school because he was reinforced for conscientious behavior when he was a child, or because other people modeled conscientious behavior for him. How do we know? Because he is now so conscientious in school and does so well there. How else could he have become so conscientious other than through reinforcement for conscientious behavior or behaving like models he has observed being rewarded for such behavior? Hypotheses like that are not merely too easy and unconstrained, but circular and not falsifiable by current methods. Economists of the rational choice persuasion sometimes exhibit the same lack of constraint and circular reasoning as psychoanalytic, evolutionary, and learning theorists. All choices are rational because the individual wouldn't have made the choice if he hadn't thought it was in his best interests. We know the person thought it was in his best interests because that's the choice the person made. The near-religious insistence that human choices are always rational leads such economists to make claims that are simultaneously untestable and tautological. The Nobel Prize-winning economist Gary Becker maintained that an individual who chooses to begin a career of drug addiction has to be considered rational if the individual's chief goal in life is to satisfy a need for instant gratification. Facile, irrefutable, and circular. If drug addiction can be explained as rational behavior by a rational choice theorist, the theory is bankrupt in that person's hands. All choices are known in advance to be rational, so nothing can be learned about the rationality of any given choice. But of course, my critique isn't limited to scientists. Mea culpa, and so are you. Many of the theories we come up with in everyday life are utterly lacking in constraints. They're cheap and lazy, tested, if at all, by searching only for confirmatory evidence, and too readily salvaged in the face of contradictory evidence. Judith, a talented young chemist, who we thought was surely headed for a distinguished career in science because of her energy and intelligence, has left the field to become a social worker. She must have a fear of success. Too easy to generate that theory and too easy to apply it. And what would convince us that fear of success was not involved? Bill, mild-mannered neighbor, erupted in rage toward his child at the big box store. He must have an angry and cruel streak that we hadn't previously seen. The representativeness heuristic, the fundamental attribution error, and the belief in the law of small numbers aid and abet one another in producing such theories willy-nilly. Once generated, evidence that should be considered as disconfirming the hypothesis can be explained away too easily. I have a theory that startups, supported by large numbers of small investors, even when little information about the company is available, are destined to be highly successful. This applies to the newly founded Bamboozle.com, so it's going to have great success. Bamboozle goes bust, but I'm going to be able to come up with any number of reasons for its failure. Management was not as talented as I had thought. The competition moved much faster than could have been predicted. I believe that announcement of a cutback of quantitative easing by the Federal Reserve will result in fear in the equity markets, causing a drop in stock values. The Fed announces a slowdown of quantitative easing, and the markets go up because of, you name it. Jennifer, disorganized in her private life, would never make a good newspaper editor, a job that requires meeting deadlines and simultaneously juggling information obtained from internet sources, assigning tasks to copy editors, and so on. Lo and behold, she turns out to be an excellent editor. The mentoring she got from her predecessor early on must have saved her from the consequences of her fundamentally chaotic temperament. I'm not saying that we shouldn't come up with hypotheses like these, just that recognition of the ease with which we generate them and the facility with which we can explain away contradictory evidence should make us cautious about believing them. The problem is that we don't recognize our own strength as theorists. Discussion of theory testing leads us to the question of just what kinds of theories can be falsified and what kinds of evidence could serve to do so. Falsifiability. If the facts don't fit the theory, change the facts. Albert Einstein. No experiment should be believed until it has been confirmed by theory. Arthur S. Eddington, astrophysicist. It's an empirical question. Is a statement that ought to end far more conversations than it does. Deductive reasoning follows logical rules, producing conclusions that can't be refuted if the premises are correct. But most knowledge is obtained not by logic, but by collecting evidence. Philosophers call conclusions that are reached by empirical means a form of defeasible reasoning. That essentially means defeatable reasoning. If you look for evidence that plausibly would support your hypothesis and it does, you may have a reasonable belief. If the data don't support your hypothesis, then you either have to find another way to support the hypothesis or hold on to it with appropriate tentativeness. Or, as Einstein said, show that the facts are mistaken. If someone makes a theoretical claim but can't tell us what kind of evidence would count against it, we should be especially wary of that person's claim. As often as not, the person's simply telling you what ideology or religion has revealed. He's operating in the prophetic mode rather than the empirical tradition. The falsifiability principle is now enshrined in law in several states as a criterion for teaching something purporting to be science. If it's not falsifiable, it's not science and can't be taught. This is intended primarily to rule out the teaching of creation science. A typical creationist claim might be, "The human eye is vastly too complicated to have come about by such a cumbersome and laborious process as evolution." The appropriate answer to that proposition is, "Who says?" Such claims are not falsifiable. The falsifiability requirement makes me slightly nervous, though, because I'm not sure the theory of evolution is falsifiable either. Darwin believed it was. He wrote, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. But I can find no such case." And no one has, or can. If the creationist says that such and such an organ could not have evolved, the evolutionist can only say, "Yes, it could." Not very convincing. And there is no way at present to test such claims empirically. Nevertheless, the theory of evolution wins out over any other theory of the origin of life, of which there are only two others, namely God and seeding by extraterrestrials. Evolution theory triumphs, not because it's falsifiable and is yet to be falsified, but because A, it's highly plausible, B, it accounts satisfactorily for countless thousands of diverse and otherwise apparently unrelated facts, C, it generates hypotheses that are testable, and D, as the great geneticist Theodosius Dobzhansky said, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." The evolutionary hypothesis and the God hypothesis are, of course, not incompatible. God works in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. Evolution is actually one of the less mysterious ways an all-powerful being might have chosen to kickstart life and keep it running all the way to us. Dobzhansky, incidentally, was a religious man. Francis Collins, the leader of the Human Genome Project and the current director of the National Institutes of Health, and obviously a believer in evolution, is an evangelical Christian. Collins would never pretend that his belief in evolution is of the same kind as his belief in God, which he would be the first to acknowledge is not falsifiable. Popper and Poppycock. The Austro-British philosopher of science and London School of Economics professor Karl Popper promulgated the view that science proceeds solely by conjecture and falsification of the conjecture or failure to falsify it. Popper maintained that induction is unreliable. In his view, we don't, or shouldn't, believe propositions simply because they're supported by evidence from which we induce that the propositions are correct. "All swans are white" was supported by millions of sightings of swans that were white and were never any other color. Oops. "Australian swans are black." Hypotheses can only be disconfirmed, not confirmed. Popper's injunction is logically correct. No amount of sightings of white swans can establish the truth of the generalization that all swans are white. There is an asymmetry. Empirical generalizations can be refuted, but can't be proved true, because they always rest on inductive evidence that could be refuted at any moment by an exception. Though correct, Popper's contention is pragmatically useless. We have to act in the world. And falsification is only a small part of the process of generating knowledge to guide our actions. Science advances mostly via induction from facts that support a theory. You have a theory based on deduction from some other theory, or from induction based on observation of available evidence, or from an inspired hunch. You then generate tests of that theory. If they support the theory, you conclude that it's more likely that the theory is correct than it would be in the absence of such evidence. If they don't support the theory, you reduce your confidence in the theory and either look for other tests or put the theory on hold. Falsification is important in science, for sure. Some facts are powerful enough that they're sufficient to utterly disabuse us of some hypothesis. Observation of chimpanzees that remained inactive and apparently asleep while being operated on after being given curare led to the hypothesis that curare obliterates consciousness. That theory went out the window when the first human was operated on under curare and reported, I assume with expletives, that he had been awake the whole time, and felt the surgeon's every excruciating maneuver. The hypothesis that the moon is made of green cheese was destroyed by Neil Armstrong in 1969. Once you know the knockdown fact, the theory is kaput. For the time being, many a theory has been knocked down only to rise again in a modified version. But mostly, research is a slog through findings that support or contradict the theory to one degree or another. The glittering prizes in science don't go to the people who falsified someone else's theory, or even one of their own, though their research may have that incidental effect. Rather, the laurels are for scientists who have made predictions based on some novel theory and demonstrated that there are important facts that support the theory and are difficult to explain in the absence of the theory. Scientists are much more likely to think they accept Popper's anti-inductive stance than philosophers of science are to endorse it. The ones I know think it's utterly wrong. Science advances mostly by induction. Popper, incidentally, criticized psychoanalytic theory as unfalsifiable and insisted it could therefore be ignored. He was quite mistaken in that. I pointed out earlier that many aspects of the theory are indeed falsifiable, and some have in fact been falsified. The central claims of psychoanalytic theory about therapeutic principles have been, if not refuted, at least shown to be dubious. There is no good evidence that people get better by virtue of dredging up buried memories and working through them with the therapist. And certainly it's the case that psychotherapeutic practices owing nothing to psychoanalytic concepts have been shown to be more effective. I was told by an eminent philosopher of science that Popper was actually quite ignorant of psychoanalytic theory. He knew only what he picked up in cafe conversations. What about Einstein's outrageous comment that facts have to change if they don't support a theory? Many interpretations of the comment are possible, but the one I prefer is that we're allowed to continue to believe a satisfying theory for which there's good support, even though there are facts that are inconsistent with the theory. If the theory is good enough, the facts will eventually be overturned. Eddington's quip makes the coordinate point. We're on shaky ground if we believe an alleged fact when there's no plausible theory that should lead us to accept it. Adherence to Eddington's rule could have spared my field of social psychology a great embarrassment. Its most venerable journal published a wildly implausible claim about extrasensory perception. An investigator asked participants to predict what statement a computer would select at random from a prepared list over a large number of trials. Participants allegedly could predict the behavior of the computer accurately at a level beyond what would be achieved by random guesses. The claim was therefore for paranormal foretelling of future events produced by a machine that could not foretell the events itself. The claim is dismissible on its face. No evidence could support such a theory. Several people with time on their hands tried to replicate the findings and couldn't. The Hawks, Odd and Post. We have many techniques that allow us to ignore evidence that on its face would seem to contradict our predictions. One of the dodges has to do with dubiously legitimate fixes to a hypothesis. Ad hoc postulates are amendments to a theory that don't follow directly from the theory and serve no purpose other than to keep the theory propped up. Ad hoc means literally to this. Ad hoc committees are subcommittees of the whole set up to deal with a specific issue. Recall from chapter 14, Aristotle's invention of the property of levity. This was an ad hoc amendment to the theory that an object's property of gravity causes it to fall to earth. Levity was postulated to handle the fact that some things float in water instead of sinking. The concept of levity is a special purpose fix to Aristotle's theory of gravity, intended to handle a problem that would otherwise wreck the theory. It doesn't follow from the basic theory in any principled way. The theory itself was what I call placebic. Nothing has actually been explained. The French playwright Molière derides such explanations when he has a character attribute a sleeping potion's effect to its dormitive virtues. Ptolemy's epicycles were an ad hoc solution to the problem that heavenly bodies did not orbit the Earth in the perfect circles that were presumed by his contemporaries to be the necessary pattern of motion. Einstein's postulation of the cosmological constant, noted in chapter 14, was a special-purpose fix to the theory of general relativity. It was postulated just to account for the fact that the universe was in a steady state. Oops, it isn't in a steady state. An astronomer has come up with an ad hoc theory to account for the failure of Mercury to orbit the Sun in the way demanded by Newton's theory. The astronomer simply posited that the Sun's center of gravity shifts from its center to the surface when and only when the planet in question is Mercury, a desperate and deliberately hilarious move to salvage a theory by a special-purpose postulate. Ad hoc theories are typically also post hoc, literally after this, meaning a contrivance after the data are in to explain what was not predicted in advance. Post hoc explanations are all too easy to come up with once an anomaly is spotted. Well, I said I was certain Joan would win the spelling contest, but I couldn't have known that she would be upset by having done badly on a math test the morning of the contest. Yes, I said Charlie would fail as manager because of his social insensitivity, but I couldn't have guessed that he would marry a woman who would trim the rough edges off him. In my first years as an academic, I habitually made confident predictions about how someone would function as a department chair or journal editor. When the predictions failed, as they did about as often as not, I had no trouble explaining why any particular prediction was off base. This spared me the necessity of recalibrating my theories about what leads to being a success in a particular role. I'm pleased to be able to say that I now make my predictions with far less certainty than before, or at least I try to keep my predictions to myself. This saves me considerable embarrassment. To this point, I've tacitly adopted the lay view that scientific investigation and theory building are cut-and-dried procedures following clear rules about hypothesis generation, the search for evidence, and acceptance or rejection of the hypothesis. For better or worse, this is far from the case, as we'll see in the next chapter. Summing up. Explanations should be kept simple. They should call on as few concepts as possible, defined as simply as possible. Effects that are the same should be explained by the same cause. Reductionism in the service of simplicity is a virtue. Reductionism for its own sake can be a vice. Events should be explained at the most basic level possible. Unfortunately, there are probably no good rules that can tell us whether an effect is an epiphenomenon lacking causal significance versus a phenomenon emerging from interactions among simpler events and having properties not explainable by those events. We don't realize how easy it is for us to generate plausible theories. The representativeness heuristic is a particularly fertile source of explanations. We are too inclined to assume that we have a causal explanation for an event if we can point to an event that resembles it. Once generated, hypotheses are given more credence than they deserve because we don't realize we could have generated many different hypotheses with as little effort and knowledge. Our approach to hypothesis testing is flawed in that we're inclined to search only for evidence that would tend to confirm a theory while failing to search for evidence that would tend to disconfirm it. Moreover, when confronted with apparently disconfirming evidence, we're all too skillful at explaining it away. A theorist who can't specify what kind of evidence would be disconfirmatory should be distrusted. Theories that can't be falsified can be believed, but with the recognition that they're being taken on faith. Falsifiability of a theory is only one virtue. Confirmability is even more important. Contra Karl Popper, science and the theories that guide our daily lives change mostly by generating supporting evidence, not by discovering falsifying evidence. We should be suspicious of theoretical contrivances that are proposed merely to handle apparently disconfirmatory evidence, but are not intrinsic to the theory. Ad hoc, post hoc fixes to theories have to be suspect because they are too easy to generate and too transparently opportunistic. Chapter 16. Keeping it real. There is nothing new to be discovered in physics now. All that remains is more and more precise measurement. William Thomson, Lord Kelvin, discoverer of the correct value of the temperature of absolute zero, in an address in 1900 to the British Association for the Advancement of Science. Arational, or non-rational or quasi-rational, practices in science occur alongside, even in opposition to, the linear, rational textbook version of scientific progress. Sometimes scientists abandon generally accepted theories and devote themselves to other theories that are not too well supported by available evidence. Their adoption of the new theory is initially as much a matter of faith as of logic or data. Scientific theories are sometimes traceable to particular worldviews that differ across academic fields, between ideologies, or from one culture to another. The different theories sometimes literally conflict with one another. The arational aspects of science may have contributed to the rejection of the concept of objective truth by some people who describe themselves as deconstructionists or postmodernists. What defense is possible against such nihilism? What can be said to people who assert that reality is mere socially constructed fiction? Paradigm shifts. 5 years after Lord Kelvin's pronouncement about the boring future of physics, Einstein published his paper on special relativity. Relativity theory literally replaced Isaac Newton's mechanics, the laws describing motion and force that had stood unchallenged for two centuries. Einstein's theory was not a mere new development in physics. It heralded a new physics. 50 years after Einstein's paper was published, the philosopher and sociologist of science, Thomas Kuhn, shook the scientific community by announcing in his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, that science doesn't always consist of an earnest slog through theory, followed by collection of data, followed by adjustment of theory. Rather, revolutions are the customary way that science makes its greatest advances. The old theory gets creaky, anomalies slowly pile up, and someone has a bright idea that sooner or later ends up overthrowing the old theory, or at least rendering it much less relevant and interesting. The new theory typically doesn't account for all the phenomena that the old theory does, and its new contentions are at first supported by data that are underwhelming at best. Often the new theory isn't concerned with explaining established facts at all, but only with predicting new ones. Kuhn's analysis was upsetting to scientists in part because it introduced an element of seeming irrationality into the concept of scientific progress. Scientists jump ship not so much because the old theory is inadequate or because new data have come in. Rather, a paradigm shift occurs because a new idea has come along that is more satisfying in some respects than the old idea, and the scientific program it suggests is more exciting. Scientists seek low-hanging fruit, startling findings suggested by the newer theory that couldn't be explained by the old theory that are ripe for the picking. Often the new theoretical approaches lead nowhere in particular, even though large numbers of scientists are pursuing them. But some new paradigms do break through and replace older views, seemingly overnight. The field of psychology offers a particularly clear example of the rapid rise of a new paradigm and the near simultaneous abandonment of an old one. Psychology from early in the 20th century till roughly the late 1960s was dominated by reinforcement learning theories. Ivan Pavlov showed that once an animal had learned that a particular arbitrary stimulus signaled a reinforcement of some kind, that stimulus would elicit the same reaction as the reinforcing agent itself. A bell that preceded the introduction of meat would come to produce the same salivary reaction as the meat itself. B.F. Skinner showed that if a given behavior was reinforced by some desirable stimulus, the behavior would be performed whenever the organism wanted the reinforcement. Rats learn to press a lever if that results in food being delivered. Psychologists produced thousands of experiments testing hypotheses derived from one or another principle suggested by Pavlovian and Skinnerian theories. During the heyday of learning theory, psychologists reached the conclusion that much of human behavior is the result of modeling. I see Jane do something for which she gets a positive reinforcement, so I learn to do the same thing to get that reinforcement. Or I see her doing something that gets her punished, so I learn to avoid that behavior. Vicarious reinforcement theory was both obvious and hard to test in a rigorous way, except by hothouse experiments showing that children sometimes imitate other people in the short term. Hit a doll, and the child may imitate that. But that doesn't show that chronically aggressive adults got that way by observing other people get rewarded for aggressive behavior. Among scientifically minded psychologists, it was de rigueur to have a reinforcement learning theory interpretation of every psychological phenomenon, whether it involved the behavior of animals or humans. Scientists who offered different interpretations of the evidence were ignored, or worse. An Achilles heel of reinforcement theory stems from the fact that it's incrementalist in nature. A light comes on and a shock follows a short time later. The animal slowly learns that the light predicts a shock. Or the animal presses a lever that produces food, and the animal gradually learns that lever pressing is its meal ticket. But phenomena began cropping up in which the animal learned almost instantaneously the connection between two stimuli. For example, an experimenter might periodically deliver an electric shock to a rat shortly after a buzzer sounded. The rat would begin to show fear, indicated by, for example, crouching or defecating, whenever the buzzer sounded. But if a light preceded the buzzer, and there was no shock, the rat would show substantially less fear on the very first trial when the light was introduced. On the next trial, there might be virtually no fear expressed at all. This suggested to many people that some types of learning could best be understood as the result of some fairly sophisticated causal thinking on the part of the rat. Around the same time the temporal puzzles were discovered, Martin Seligman delivered an extremely serious blow to one of the most central tenets of traditional learning theory, namely that you could pair any arbitrary stimulus with any other arbitrary stimulus, and an animal would learn that association. Seligman showed that the arbitrariness dictum was hopelessly wrong. Recall from Chapter 8 that associations the animal was not prepared to learn would not be learned. Dogs can readily learn to go to the right if a light appears on the right rather than the left, but not if it appears on top rather than on the bottom. Pigeons will starve to death while a learning theorist tries to teach them that not pecking at a light will produce a food pellet. The failures of learning theory to account for the extremely rapid learning of some connections and the impossibility of learning other connections were not initially seen as the body blows that they were. The danger to learning theory came not from these anomalies, but from seemingly unrelated work on cognitive processes, including memory, the influence of schemas on visual perception and interpretation of events, and causal reasoning. Many psychologists began to see that the really exciting phenomena to be examined had to do with thinking rather than learning. Almost overnight, hundreds of investigators began studying the operations of the mind, and study of learning processes came to a virtual halt. Learning theory was not so much disproved as ignored. In retrospect, it can be seen that the program of research had become what the philosopher of science Imre Lakatos termed a degenerative research paradigm, one that is no longer producing interesting findings. Just more and more about less and less. The new opportunities were in the field of cognition and later in the field of cognitive neuroscience. Within very few years, virtually no one was studying learning, and few cognitive scientists deigned to pay attention to learning theory interpretations of their findings. As in science, great changes in technology, industry, and commerce are often due to revolution rather than evolution. The steam engine is invented, resulting in the replacement of wool by cotton as the main fabric used for clothing in many parts of the world. Trains are invented, resulting in the deregionalizing of manufacturing. Mass production of goods in factories arrives, ending time immemorial manufacturing techniques. Within a brief period of time, the invention of the internet changed everything. One difference between paradigmatic changes in science and those in technology and business practices is that the old paradigm often as not hangs around in science. Cognitive science didn't replace all learning theory findings or even the explanations behind the findings. Rather, it just established a body of work that couldn't have been produced within the learning theory framework. Science and culture. Bertrand Russell once observed that scientists studying the problem-solving behavior of animals saw in their experimental subjects the national characteristics of the scientists themselves. The pragmatic Americans and the theoretically inclined Germans had very different understandings of what was happening. Animals studied by Americans rush about frantically, with an incredible display of hustle and pep and at last achieved the desired result by chance. Animals observed by Germans sit still and think, and at last evolve the solution out of their inner consciousness. Ouch. Any psychologist knows there was more than a grain of truth in Russell's lampoon. Indeed, the groundwork for the cognitive revolution was laid by Western Europeans, especially Germans, who worked primarily on perception and thinking rather than learning. American soil was pretty barren for cognitive theory, and work on thought would undoubtedly have come along much later if not for prodding by Europeans. It's no accident that social psychology, which was founded by Europeans, was never behaviorized in the first place. In addition to having to acknowledge the irrational aspects of paradigm shifts, scientists have had to come to grips with the fact that cultural beliefs can profoundly influence scientific theories. The Greeks believed in the stability of the universe, and scientists from Aristotle to Einstein were enthralled to this commitment. The Chinese, in contrast, were confident that the world was constantly changing. Chinese attention to context led to their correct understanding of acoustics, magnetism, and gravity. Continental social scientists shake their heads in exasperation with what they call the rigid, methodological individualism of American social scientists and their inability to see the relevance or even the existence of larger social structures and of the zeitgeist. The major advances in thinking about societies and organizations have primarily continental rather than Anglo-Saxon roots. Western primatologists could see no social interaction among chimpanzees more complicated than the behavior that a pair of chimps exhibited toward each other, until Japanese primatologists showed the very complicated nature of chimpanzee politics. Even the preferred forms of reasoning differ across cultures. Logic is foundational for Western thought, dialecticism for East Asian thought. The two types of thinking can produce literally contradictory results. The rapid and incompletely justified nature of shifts in scientific theories, together with recognition of the role of culture in affecting scientific views, contradicted the picture of science as an enterprise of pure rationality, operating in the light of unshakable facts. These deviations may have contributed to a thoroughly anti-scientific approach to reality that began to gain steam in the late 20th century. Reality as a text. After we came out of the church, we, Samuel Johnson and his biographer James Boswell, stood talking for some time together of Bishop Berkeley's ingenious sophistry to prove the non-existence of matter and that everything in the universe is merely ideal. I, Boswell, observed that though we are satisfied his doctrine is not true, it is impossible to refute it. I never shall forget the alacrity with which Johnson answered, striking his foot with mighty force against a large stone, till he rebounded from it, "I refute it thus." James Boswell, The Life of Samuel Johnson. Not everyone today seems to be as readily convinced of the reality of reality as Johnson. Recall the umpire from Chapter 1, who denied any reality to the concepts of strikes and balls other than his labeling of them as such. Many people who call themselves postmodernists or deconstructionists would endorse that umpire's view. In Jacques Derrida's phrase, "Il n'y a pas de hors texte," there is nothing outside of the text. People with such orientations sometimes deny that there is any there at all. Reality is merely a construction, and nothing exists other than our interpretation of it. The fact that interpretations of some aspect of the world can be widely or even universally shared is irrelevant. Such agreement only indicates that there are shared social constructions. One of my favorite phrases from this movement is that there are no facts, only regimes of truth. This extreme subjectivist view drifted over to America from France in the 1970s. The general idea behind deconstructionism is that texts can be dismantled to show the ideological leanings, values, and arbitrary perspectives that underlie all inferences about the world, including assertions posing as facts about nature. An anthropologist of my acquaintance was asked by a student at my university how anthropologists deal with the problem of reliability concerning characterizations of the beliefs and behavior of people in other cultures. In other words, What to do about the sometimes varying interpretations of different anthropologists? She replied, "The problem doesn't arise, because what we anthropologists do is interpret what we see. Different people are expected to have different interpretations because of their different assumptions and viewpoints." This answer scandalized my student and me. If you're doing science, agreement is everything. If observers can't agree about whether a given phenomenon exists, then scientific interpretation can't even get launched. What you have is a mess. But my mistake was in thinking that cultural anthropologists necessarily regard themselves as scientists. Early on in my work on cultural psychology, I tried to make contact with cultural anthropologists. I wanted to learn from them, and I expected they would be interested in my empirical work on cultural differences in thought and behavior. I was shocked to discover that most of the people defining themselves as cultural anthropologists had no desire to talk to me and no use for my data. They were not about to privilege, their term, my evidence over their interpretations. To my astonishment, postmodernist nihilism made strong headway in academic fields ranging from literary studies to history to sociology. How strong? An acquaintance told me about asking a student whether she thought the laws of physics were mere arbitrary assertions about nature. "Yes," she assured her questioner. "Well, when you're up in an airplane, you figure any old laws of physics could keep it in the air?" "Absolutely," she replied. A survey of students at a major university by the philosopher and political scientist James Flynn found that most believed that modern science is merely one point of view. Those poor students came by their opinion honestly. It was encouraged by the sort of thing they had been told in many of their humanities and social science courses. One might think that professors in those fields were merely amusing themselves or perhaps trying to stimulate thought on the part of their students. But consider the tale of the physicist and the postmodernists. In 1996, Alan Sokol, a physics professor at New York University, sent a manuscript to Social Text, a journal with a proudly postmodern stance and an editorial roster including some quite famous academics. Sokol's article, titled "Transgressing the Boundaries Towards a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity," tested just how much nonsense such a journal was willing to swallow. The article, saturated with postmodern jargon, announced that an external world whose properties are independent of any individual human being was dogma imposed by the long post-Enlightenment hegemony over the Western intellectual outlook. Because scientific research is inherently theory-laden and self-referential, it cannot assert a privileged epistemological status with respect to counter-hegemonic narratives emanating from dissident or marginalized communities. Quantum gravity was pronounced a mere social construction. Sokol's article was accepted without peer review. On the day of publication of his article in Social Text, Sokol revealed in the journal Lingua Franca that the article was a pseudoscientific hoax. The editors of Social Text responded that the article's status as parody does not alter substantially our interest in the piece itself as a symptomatic document. George Orwell said that some things are so stupid that only intellectuals believe them. But to be fair, no one actually believes that reality is merely a text, though many people undoubtedly think they believe it. Or did. Postmodernism is gradually fading from the North American academic scene. It dissipated long ago in France, where, as my French anthropologist friend Dan Sperber said, it never even had the prestige of being French. Should you find yourself in a conversation with a postmodernist, and I can't wholeheartedly recommend you do, try the following. Ask whether the balance in the person's credit card statement is a mere social construction, or ask whether he thinks power differentials in society are merely a matter of interpretation, or whether they have some basis in reality. I have to admit, incidentally, that postmodernist concerns have produced some research related to power, ethnicity, and gender that seems valid and important. The anthropologist Ann Stoller, for example, has done very interesting research on the shaky and sometimes hilarious criteria used by the Dutch in colonial Indonesia to determine who was and was not white. Nothing so straightforward as the American rule that anyone with a single drop of African blood was a Negro which of course was a social construction without any remote basis in physical reality. Stoller's work is of substantial interest to historians, to anthropologists, and to psychologists interested in how people categorize the world and how people's motivations influence their understanding of the world. What I find particularly ironic about postmodernists is that they asserted without evidence that interpretations of reality are always just that, and did so in the complete absence of knowledge about the findings by psychologists that support a contention only slightly less radical on its face than postmodernists' views. One of the greatest accomplishments of psychologists is the demonstration of the philosopher's dictum that everything from the perception of motion to understanding of the workings of our own minds is an inference. Nothing in the world is known as directly or infallibly as intuition tells us it is. But the fact that everything is an inference doesn't mean that any inference is as defensible as another. Should you find yourself at the zoo with a postmodernist, don't let him get away with telling you that your belief that the large animal with a trunk and tusks is an elephant is a mere inference, because it could be a mouse with a glandular condition. Summing up, science is based not only on evidence and well-justified theories. Faith and hunches may cause scientists to ignore established scientific hypotheses and agreed-upon facts. Several years ago, the literary agent John Brockman asked scores of scientists and public figures to tell him about something they believed they couldn't prove, and he published their responses in a book. In many instances, an individual's most important work was guided by hypotheses that could never be proved. As laypeople, we have no choice but to do the same. The paradigms that underlie a given body of scientific work, as well as those that form the basis for technologies, industries, and commercial enterprises, are subject to change without notice. These changes are often initially underdetermined by the evidence. Sometimes the new paradigm exists in uneasy partnership with the old, and sometimes it utterly replaces the old. Different cultural practices and beliefs can produce different scientific theories, paradigms, and even forms of reasoning. The same is true for different business practices. Quasi-rational practices by scientists and cultural influences on belief systems and reasoning patterns may have encouraged postmodernists and deconstructionists to press the view that there are no facts, only socially agreed upon interpretations of reality. They clearly don't live their lives as if they believed this, but they nevertheless expended a colossal amount of university teaching and research effort promulgating these nihilistic views. Did these teachings contribute to the rejection of scientific findings in favor of personal prejudices so common today? Conclusion. The Tools of the Lay Scientist. This book has brought you some bad news and some good news. The bad news is that our beliefs about many important aspects of the world are often sorely mistaken, and the ways in which we acquire them are often fundamentally flawed. Our conviction that we know the world directly by unmediated perception of facts is what philosophers call naive realism. Every belief about every aspect of the world is based on countless inferences we make via mental processes we can't observe. We're dependent on innumerable schemas and heuristics to characterize accurately even the simplest objects and events. We frequently fail to see the role of context in producing the behavior of humans and even of physical objects. We're often oblivious to the role played by the social influences that drive our judgments and guide our behavior. Countless stimuli affect our beliefs and behavior without our knowledge, sometimes even without our awareness of their existence. Our belief that we know what goes on in our heads is far wide of the mark. When we can correctly identify the mental process that produced some judgment or solved some problem, we do so not by observing those processes, but by applying theories about those processes. And those theories are often wrong. We're overly influenced by anecdotal evidence. This problem is amplified by our failure to understand the importance of having lots of information relevant to the judgment at hand. We operate as if we thought the law of large numbers also applied to small numbers. We are particularly blind to the possibility that our evidence is insufficient when it comes to making some of the most important judgments, namely about the characteristics of other people. We have great difficulty correctly identifying relationships between even highly important events. If we think there's a relationship, we're likely to see it even if it isn't there. If we think there's not likely to be a relationship, we frequently fail to detect it, even when it's quite strong. We generate theories about the world with abandon, having little understanding that the ease with which we do so is no indication a given theory is correct. In particular, we're profligate causal theorists. Given an effect, we readily, even automatically, and without reflection, come up with a theory about its cause. Even when we think to test the theory, we're flawed as intuitive scientists. We tend to look exclusively for confirming evidence, while failing to look for equally probative evidence that might serve to discredit the theory. When we're forced to confront disconfirming evidence, we're gifted at explaining it away, being unaware of how easy it is for us to generate ad hoc defenses of our original theory. The bottom line for all this: our beliefs are often badly mistaken. We're way too confident about our ability to acquire new knowledge that accurately characterizes the world, and our behavior often fails to advance our interests and those of people we care about. The good news is the flip side of the bad news. You already knew you were fallible before you heard this book. You now know much more about what produces your failings and how to compensate for them. This knowledge will help you perceive the world more accurately and behave more sensibly. What you've heard also serves as a weapon to guard against the flawed assertions of others, friends and acquaintances, as well as people in the media. You'll often apply the concepts and rules you've learned automatically, even without awareness that you're applying them, and that's going to be increasingly true over time. Use a new tool in this book a few times, and you'll frequently have it when you need it. You're not going to forget the law of large numbers and its implications for the amount of evidence needed, and every time you apply the law, you're going to be more likely to use it in the future, in an ever-widening range of events. You're not going to forget the admonition to pay more attention to social context in order to explain your behavior and that of others. On the contrary, you'll be getting constant feedback, showing you that you've understood some situation better than you would have in the past, and that reinforcement is going to result in your applying the concept more and more frequently in the future. You're going to have the sunk cost and opportunity cost concepts available to you for the rest of your life. So, you're a better scientist in your everyday life than when you began this book. But I don't want to oversell just how much you're going to be able to change the way you think. I violate most of the principles in this book frequently, and many of them constantly. Some of our psychological tendencies are just very deeply rooted, and they're not going to be extirpated by learning some new principles intended to reduce their untoward effects. But I know these tendencies can be modified, and their damage limited, by virtue of knowing about them and how to combat them. You're also a better consumer and media critic now than when you began this book. Let's consider a couple of reports and one letter to the editor that I read in highly respected newspapers while I was drafting this final chapter. The New York Times reported that married couples who had big weddings had longer-lasting, more satisfying marriages than couples who had smaller weddings. But I'm betting that you wouldn't start encouraging your friends to crank out more wedding invitations. I'm hoping it would have occurred to you that people who have big weddings are, on average, older, better off financially, have known each other longer, and are possibly more in love than people who have smaller weddings. All these factors are correlated with marital happiness. We have learned precisely nothing from the finding that there is a correlation between size of wedding and marriage satisfaction. The Associated Press reported highway safety data for a large number of 2011 model autos. Findings included the fact that death rates per million cars for Subaru Legacy sedans and Toyota Highlander hybrid SUVs, among other autos, were vastly lower than death rates for Chevrolet Silverado 1500 pickups and Jeep Patriot SUVs, for example. I'm hoping that had you read that article, you would have considered that the death rate per car is a less accurate measure of safety than the death rate per mile, since average number of miles driven undoubtedly differs substantially across vehicle types. More important to consider are the characteristics of the typical drivers of the vehicles. Which type of car is most likely to be driven by the proverbial little old lady from Pasadena or a Westchester County, New York soccer mom, which is most likely to be driven by hell-raising young Texas cowboys or pampered California teenagers. The Wall Street Journal published a letter in 2012 from an MIT climate scientist and others, maintaining that global warming is minimal and apparently ceasing, citing as evidence the fact that there had been no increase in global temperatures since 1998. I would hope it might have occurred to you to think about what the standard deviation might be for temperature changes from one year to another. They're quite large, actually. Moreover, as for any partially random process, there are surprisingly many long runs. Temperature change, like many phenomena, doesn't move in a straight line, but rather in fits and starts. And in fact, 2014 turned out to be the hottest year on record. There were a couple of other reasons to be dubious about the letter. Signers of the letter included a geneticist, a spaceship designer, and someone described as a former astronaut and U.S. senator, suggesting that the bottom of the expertise barrel was being scraped. And the letter compared the firing of a journal editor, allegedly for writing an article doubting climate change, to the imprisonment and execution of Soviet scientists who doubted Lysenko's genetic views. No kidding. So in many cases, you'll be able to rebut, or at least have solid reasons for doubting, claims by acquaintances and the media that you might have accepted before. But more often than in the past, you're going to be alert to the fact that you just don't have the tools to test a given claim. Few of us can critique claims such as stents are better than coronary artery grafting for most plugged aorta problems, or amino acids from crashed comets could have laid the groundwork for life on Earth, or the oil reserves on the American continental shelf exceed those of Saudi Arabia's. We're all lay scientists at best with respect to almost all information we get about almost all domains. So normally, you'll have to turn to other sources. That would be putative experts in the field pertinent to your concerns. What's the proper stance toward the experts in a given field, assuming you can find them? Here are the philosopher Bertrand Russell's mild propositions about how to deal with expert opinion. When the experts are agreed, the opposite opinion cannot be held to be certain. When they are not agreed, no opinion can be regarded as certain by a non-expert. When they all hold that no sufficient grounds for a positive opinion exist, the ordinary man would do well to suspend his judgment. Mild propositions indeed. Too mild, maybe? Many years ago, I attended a psychology department talk by someone who billed himself as a computer scientist. Not many people used that job title in those days. The speaker began by announcing, "I am going to deal with the question of what it might mean to humans' conceptions of themselves if one day computers could beat any international chess master, write a better novel or symphony than any human, and solve fundamental questions about the nature of the world that have stumped the greatest intellects throughout history." His next utterance produced an audible gasp from the audience. I want to make two things clear at the outset. First, I don't know whether computers will ever be able to do those things. Second, I'm the only person in the room with a right to an opinion on the question. The second sentence has rung in my ears ever since that day. The speaker shocked me into the habit of subjecting other people's claims and my own to the expertise test. You constantly hear people express firm opinions about some matter for which there may be, in fact, you know there to be, expert opinion available. Does the person have a right to claim expertise, like the computer scientist I heard decades ago? Does the person believe his opinion is based on that of experts? Does the person know what range of opinions there is among the experts? Does the person even know whether there are experts? Does the person care whether there are experts? Scientists certainly care about whether there are experts. They often make progress by questioning the received wisdom of experts. My career illustrates that. It's been one long series of discoveries that experts, usually including me, at the outset of my research, can be mistaken. Here are some of the dozens of cases where I've found the experts to be dead wrong. Many obese people are not overeating, as the experts and I believed, but rather defending a set point for fat tissue. People don't have introspective access to their mental processes, as cognitive psychologists, including me, believed. Rather, when they're right about what went on in their heads, it's because they happen to have a correct theory about how they arrived at a given judgment or solved a particular problem. Often, however, such theories are mistaken. Like most people studying statistical reasoning, I was confident that the teaching of statistical principles could have only minimal effects on people's reasoning in everyday life. Thank goodness I was wrong, and this book is due in part to that discovery. Economists and reinforcement theory psychologists have long believed that incentives, usually of the monetary sort, are the best way to change behavior. But monetary incentives are often useless or worse, and there are many other less expensive and less coercive ways to change behavior. For the better part of a century, experts in the field of intelligence agreed that intelligence is essentially one thing, namely IQ as measured by standard tests, that it's little influenced by environmental factors, and that differences in IQ between blacks and whites are due in part to genes. All of that is wrong. I have some expertise that allowed me to confront expert opinion in all these areas. But unfortunately, my expertise is limited to the small number of fields I've worked in. I'm pretty much just a lay scientist with respect to everything else. And that's true for all of us. So how to regard the experts in the fields we need to know something about? I'd go further than Bertrand Russell. It's not just that you shouldn't be certain of an opinion opposite to that of the experts when the experts are agreed. Rather, it would seem unwise not to simply accept their opinion, unless you have solid grounds for believing that you have some alternate expertise that allows you to doubt the general consensus. It's foolish to assume that our ignorance or the views of an entertainment celebrity delivered on a talk show are better guides to the truth than the expert's knowledge. Of course, it can be very hard to find out what the consensus of experts is on many matters. Indeed, in the name of balance, the media often do their best to confuse you as to whether there is a consensus. If they have a presumed expert giving her view on some issue, they find another expert with a different view. I often see this balancing act when I know for sure that the strong consensus of experts holds to one view over the other. The near universal consensus among climate experts is that change is occurring, due at least in part to human activities. Yet it's been reported that the Fox News president, Roger Ailes, has standing orders that anyone presenting this view must be rebutted by someone who denies the correctness of the consensus. So it's easy to be misled by the media, whether motivated by political goals or more often by a misguided insistence on balance, into believing there's a significant division of expert opinion, and therefore that it's reasonable to pick among various positions. But believe me, you can always find someone with a PhD to support any crank opinion. Evolution? Hooey! Alien visits to our planet? Without doubt. Vaccinations cause autism? Absolutely. Megadoses of vitamin C combat the common cold? Darn tootin'. It's getting easier to know what the consensus of experts is on a given subject. Fortunately, in fields where it's important for us to have accurate knowledge, such as health and education, there are reputable websites such as Mayo Clinic and the What Works Clearinghouse that make the job easier. But the internet is not a panacea. I can assure you that anything having to do with gender differences in behavior and some things having to do with gender differences in biology should be viewed with a beady eye. See what you think about my suggestions for how to approach the question of expert opinion about matters that are important to you or to society as a whole. 1. Try to find out whether there is such a thing as expertise about the question. There is no expertise about astrology. 2. If there is such a thing as expertise, try to find out whether there is a consensus among the experts. 3. If there is a consensus, then the stronger that consensus seems to be, the less choice you have about whether to accept it. Winston Churchill said, "Democracy is the worst form of government except for all those others that have been tried." Experts are the worst people to trust, except for all those other people whose views you might consult. And bear in mind that I'm an expert on the question of the expertise of experts.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Mindware, Tools for Smart Thinking, written by Richard E. Nisbet, performed by Joe Barrett, producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2015 by Richard E. Nisbet. Production copyright 2015 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.